Welcome tonight to this Middle East Center presentation by Benedetta Voltolini, who is now Marie Sklodowska Curie Fellow at Sciences Po in Paris, used to be a PhD student here in the Department of International Relations. Has just published a book on lobbying and EU foreign policy in the Arab-Israeli context. And tonight she's going to talk a bit, I hope, about the book and also about her current research. I am your chair, Federica Bicchi. I'm an associate professor in the Department of International Relations. What's going to happen is that Benedetta is going to speak for roughly half an hour. Yeah? And after that, it's going to be over to you for questions, comments, and anything that you might like to raise within, obviously, the academic boundaries that characterize the LSE. But without further ado, Benedetta, would you like to start?
Thank you, Federica. And thank you, everyone, for being here. And thank you for the, I thank you also, the Middle East Center, for giving me this opportunity to present my work on lobbying and framing in EU foreign policy.
Hold on a second. Can you hear
me? Can you hear me, or should I speak?
Yeah? Okay. Is that good?
So today's presentation will be on lobbying and framing, and I will draw on the case study of Israel and Palestine. So the presentation will be organized in three main parts. First, I will explain why lobbying in EU foreign policy. Then I will move about this link between lobbying and framing, and I will give you some ideas about the Israeli-Palestinian case and the framework that I use to understand framing processes in the EU foreign policy towards Israel. And then I will also discuss where my current research is going and some ideas that I'm trying to develop. And I'm very happy to receive also your feedback on this new project. So to lobbying in EU foreign policy. Well, actually it's a very research topic, because probably most of you, when you think about EU foreign policy towards the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, you think about that, Mogherini, or you think about Merkel going to Israel for a business trip. But actually, there is also another side of this story that is based on a lot of interest groups, a lot of actors that are trying to shape and influence what is going on and what European foreign policy is about and what policies the European Union implements. And this is not something so unusual if you come from a public policy perspective, in which, I mean, the role of interest group is studies and it is emphasized. And even in the European Union, we know a lot about interest group and how they try to shape EU policies in general. But we don't know much about what happens in EU foreign policy. We have some anecdotes by journalists that tell you, for example, that there was a massive pressure from the, for example, pro-Israel lobbying, trying to shape the votes of the European Parliament on a certain resolution or on a certain agreement. Or we might see the campaigns of the BDS movement, the Boycott and Divestment and Sanction movement. So we have some example of that, but we don't really know much about it in from an academic perspective. And I would argue that actually these actors matter a lot, even in foreign policy, although an idea is that, well, European foreign policy is high politics, so it doesn't matter, we don't need to study interest groups. No, we need to, because they are extremely active and they really try to shape what EU foreign policy is about. And because of this, that's where my interest for lobbying in EU foreign policy started. And the case of Israel-Palestine is salient in EU foreign policy because the European Union has a long position on the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. It has developed a position over the decades, and the Israeli-Palestinian conflict has always been on the agenda of of the European Union. So what? So this is the background, basically, of the current research on lobbying and framing, and why lobbying and framing? Well, lobbying and framing because lobbying in the European Union is informational lobbying. So it is about providing information, providing expertise. It's not about paying someone or giving money or providing material benefits. And the literature on lobbying is also looking a lot now at the issue of framing. Framing meaning how these groups try to describe or shift or focus the attention on one specific issue. They try to shift the attention of policymakers on specific issues so that then this might influence the policy outcome. Because you can say that framing is a process of selecting, emphasizing, and organizing aspects of complex issues, and then you provide an evaluative analytical criterion that then steers policy. And in that sense, I think that it's also important to see how these framing processes work in European foreign policy and how this framing also shifts policies. So basically what I am interested in and what I have done was to look at policy change in EU foreign policy and understanding it as a process originating in an ideational change, as a framing process. And because of the role that non-state actors also play in this framing issue, taking that from the lobbying literature, I try to combine the two aspects, so the study of framing and the study of lobbying. And so my main argument is that non-state actors, so interest group, they can be NGOs, business group, etc., play an important role in these framing processes because they can trigger these framing processes and they can act, as I call them, as frame entrepreneurs. And by triggering these framing processes, these can also then lead to policy change. I'm not arguing that they are the only actor that can trigger these framing processes, but they are one of the actors that we can consider when looking at these framing processes. And I studied that in the case of EU foreign policy towards Israel and Palestine, and particularly I look at a shift that happened in EU foreign policy towards Israel that was quite clear with the publication of the guidelines in 2013. The guidelines, and I will come back to this case later, but the guidelines were basically a new policy that the European implemented when dealing with its funding to Israel, and specifying that the funding in prizes, grants, and funding under other programs has to go to Israel as internationally defined and not to the settlements in the West Bank. So how did I analyze this policy change? So I basically looked at policy change in EU foreign policy as a framing process through which member states, EU institutions define a new understanding of the issue at stake, and this then leads to new initiative. And the key elements of this framework of that I use are taken from Kingdon and from Bicky work. And basically, the idea is that change and these framing processes happen when actors face cognitive uncertainty, when they are puzzled about the interpretation of the social reality, and they don't know also how to make sense of the information out there. And this cognitive uncertainty is often raised when the issues are also politicized and securitized. And this cognitive uncertainty opens up a policy window that basically allows to a policy entrepreneur to exploit the situation and foster these framing processes so that a new frame develops, cognitive uncertainty is solved, and we can have policy change. And these entrepreneurs basically act as a broker between the different actors that are part of this framing process and mediates and helps to bring about these new ideas, these new frames. So I share this basic framework, but I see it a couple of elements in a slightly different way. So in the case of policy entrepreneurs, in the case of EU foreign policy, these policy entrepreneurs have always been considered either member states or EU institutions. And my point is that, well, we should also include non-state actors. Maybe they are not policy entrepreneurs in the sense that they cannot act on a policy and they cannot really implement the policy, but they can be a frame entrepreneur in the sense that they can trigger this process of framing. And secondly, when we look at cognitive uncertainty, the point is that I think cognitive uncertainty can also be constructed when actors are simply faced by a problem by other actors. So another actor can create this cognitive uncertainty by showing a problem from a different perspective. And this triggers this cognitive uncertainty. But what I have found in this case study is that you also need some external factors, some exogenous factors that also act as catalysts and then favor really these framing processes to take place and to develop. So the case basically of EU and of EU foreign policy towards Israel. So as I mentioned before, there was this shift, there was this new policy enacted in 2013 with the guidelines on funding to Israel and not to the settlements, basically. And to me, this was a quite significant policy change because there was a legal instrument that was created and that marked a bit a change in the policy. Why? Because before, the European Union has always had a position of not recognition of the settlements, of the Israeli settlements, but this has mainly remained at the declaratory level. Here with the guidelines, even though they are not as such a legally binding instrument, because they are published in the series C of the official journal, which is not a law per se, but they explain how the Commission is going to execute the budget and how it's going to implement its policy. So the document is binding on the institution and provides also legal effects because there is a link to the financial regulations of the European Union. And therefore, there are also measures to act upon if these guidelines are not followed. And my interest was, okay, how do we come about that? I mean, why it was implemented? What happened? And by investigating how we reached this point, it was interesting to see this shift in a frame. So the European Union, before, had a frame that was based on what I call a political frame or a conflict-based frame, that was based on this idea that, and was very much shaped by the Oslo years, in a way. So there is a peace process going on, and we cannot interfere into this peace process, and we need to enact positive conditionality and to casual also Israel to remain in the peace process. And so therefore they didn't want to, for example, link the Middle East peace process with the bilateral relations that in the 90s were started to develop really strongly. While what happens with the guidelines and the policy that the frame that underpins these guidelines is what I call a legal frame, or what is also called a differentiation policy or a policy of differentiation, which shifts the perspective and says, well, we as the European Union are a community of law, and we have certain laws ourselves And we have to respect the commitments that we have in international law and under international humanitarian law. And therefore, we need to implement our policies towards Israel in respect of these of this commitment, of these obligations that we have. And this doesn't mean that we leave Israel and the Palestinians and then decide what their final borders will be. But in the meantime, in our bilateral dealings, for us, the territorial scope, basically, where these agreements, where our policy will be implemented, will be Israel as internationally defined, so within the green line. And and so, to understand how this framing process started, I started to investigate a bit more, and I did a lot of process tracing, etc. And it came up that there was an important role of an NGO that acted as a frame entrepreneur over the years, and we will see, and I could see a process of construction of uncertainty, this opening of a window of opportunity, and then this codification of a new frame. How it happened. So back in the 90s, the European Union had signed the an association agreement with Israel, which of course covered mainly and predominantly trade back then, and contained also a preferential treatment opportunity, which meant that the goods exchanged between the parties were subjected to no duties or lower duties than what the normal tariff would be. And the problem of the agreement back then was that the problem or how the agreement was structured, it didn't distinguish between Israel and the territories it conquered after and occupied after 1967. And so Israel, because of its internal and domestic law, was applying this agreement also to the Israeli settlements and to the export to Europe. And what happened is that this NGO started to raise the issue and saying, here we have a problem, because you are applying these agreements, or these agreements is applied by Israel also to the territories, which is against your AWAN obligations under international law, but also it's against your AWAN regulation, because in the 80s, the European Union had issued a regulation saying that the West Bank, the Gaza Strip, East Jerusalem, and the Golan Heights constitute a separate costume union and a separate entity for trade with the European Union. So they raised this NGO raised this issue and started meeting a lot of officials and started dealing with and presenting this problem. So, and that's what I called, it started to create cognitive uncertainty in the sense that it started to present a problem that it was not there before. And it started to say, okay, but here we have a problem, you need to act upon that. But in the 90s, early 2000s, this was not enough. Policymakers, and that's what they told me, many found that too technical, some of them were not really convinced, and so what happened is that in 2005 they reached a technical arrangement and said so the goods needs to be exported with a postcode so that our customs authority can distinguish between the goods produced in Israel as internationally recognized and the settlement. But this NGO didn't stop, and it continued presenting this problem, and it also started also opening it to other issues where you had this territorial component. And in 2009, 2010, around these years, there was what I call this opening of a policy windows, in the sense that there was the Gaza war, and so this also changed a lot the mood in the European Union. Netanyahu, new government and his policy were not stopping the settlements, but they were continuing the construction of the settlements. And the European Parliament also started to become quite vocal about the issue of settlements. And this, together with this cognitive uncertainty that was generated over the decades, led to new demands from policymakers, that they were trying to understand how they could interpret EU-Israel relation, still keeping the relation with Israel and deepening it, but at the same time ensuring that they were not infringing their own legislation and their commitment under international law. And that's what I see leading to this new frame and then to this new policy, so to this idea that we keep the relationship, we strengthen this relationship, but we do that within the limit of the legal possibilities that we have, and basically ensuring that law is respected and that we as a community of law, we as European Union, don't disregard this aspect. So this is a very short version of the story. So this is basically the big pictures that I studied, so how these framing processes happen in that specific case. Now I moved a bit farther and I'm working on that. And this look a bit at the issue of networks and entrepreneurs, because here we see this idea of an NGO acting as a frame entrepreneur. But then, of course, the question is, where does this agency come about? How can agent produce also this structural change? And of course, the literature on policy entrepreneurs is also not always clear about that. And that's where I think that that combining that with the idea of networks could help. Why? Because networks can provide this structure that helps us to see these processes of framing, how these actors are linked. But also, networks assume that some structural position in the network, so some position in this series of links, gives a structural advantage to certain actors to act, because they control information, because they are central to these flows of information, and therefore they might decide to act upon this structural advantage that can lead to create change. But linked to that and to this idea of political entrepreneurship, I was also asking myself, in line with some of the literature in public policy, whether it makes sense maybe to distinguish different types of entrepreneurs. As I said, I used the name frame entrepreneur because the actor I identified was not is not officially part of any decision-making process. So it acted, if you want, at more the what you could call maybe the agenda-setting state. But then my question was, but then why the guidelines, why this frame was translated and codified in that specific form and shape of policy? And then here my question would be, maybe there was another entrepreneur in this network that activated the policy formulation and the form that it took, and maybe mediated between also different interests, institutional interests, member states interests, etc. So that's why I'm also thinking now, is it worth analytically distinguishing, and what different feature different entrepreneurs might have at different stages of the policy making process? And finally, that was it's a final point that is really an idea that was discussed with some of my colleagues about lobbying and framing as practice. And so I'm looking at the common doings between actors and looking at how, for example, maybe lobbying and framing happens when these people share a common endeavor. And so give a different perspective on lobbying, which is not what is mainly assumed in the literature, a more rational choice perspective. So I lobby you, you decide to receive it or not, and that's it. But looking when a common endeavor develops, also a common understanding, and then produce these new frames. I think I will stop here, and I'm happy to develop further if there are questions.